Hi, listener. I'm going to jump in before the episode, as always, to give you some content warnings before we get into it. This week's episode discusses various heavy topics, which may be upsetting or triggering to some listeners. Those topics include, but are not limited to, with brief mentions of big game hunting, the United States military and government structure, military service, World War II, the Vietnam War, the Nazi Party, Pearl Harbor, North Korea, xenophobia, the Red Scare, Cold War era communism, war crimes, and the killing of children. If this episode is not for you, I totally understand. Please take care of yourself and come back to us next week if you feel up to it. Thank you so much for your support and hanging around. With that said, let's get into the episode.
Check yourself, sweaty.
Hi, and welcome to Author's Note.
Don't like, don't listen.
My name is Cass.
And my name is Tease.
Tease.
Cass, how are you?
I am excited and terrified for today's episode, but I think it's going to be a good discussion.
Okay. I trust you. I'm excited for this.
Before we dive into it, we are on a new day of the week.
Yes. Hello. Hi.
We're coming to you from Tuesday.
We're now Tuesday episodes instead of Monday. Sometimes life just becomes life. So we obviously work day jobs and we have lives outside of the podcast. This isn't a profession for us. So we just have to move to Tuesdays. Sorry about that, guys.
I think it's better. Have I told you my feelings about the days of the week? I think
Tuesday is
unequivocally the worst day of the week.
Fascinating.
Hear me out. Okay. Monday, start of a fresh new week. You know, we're getting going. We're going with good vibes. Everything is refreshed. We're starting over. Listen, I know it's difficult going back to work if you work a traditional 9-to-5. But listen, Monday's the reset. Things can change on a Monday. Wednesday, it's hump day. You're halfway through. You're almost done. Thursday, man, Friday's tomorrow. It's going into that easy slide. It's all downhill from here in the good way. Friday, it's Friday. Need I say more? Saturday, everybody loves a weekend. Sunday, that's Garfield's day. We chill on that day. Tuesday, literally nothing. Nothing to look forward to. It is the sophomore slump of weekdays.
I have friends that stream on Tuesday, though, and I watch them stream on Tuesdays, and it makes Tuesday better.
We gotta inject goodness into Tuesday. That's the deal.
That is true. In the grand scheme of things, Tuesdays. I hear that. So, author's notes now, Tuesday's notes.
Yeah.
Don't like on Tuesdays, listen on Mondays still.
Exactly.
Old episodes. Wait. It's fine. Yeah.
We have some exciting stuff. So, this week on Thursday, you will get to hear the Neopets bonus episode. Patrons got access to that early. Thank you so much to the members of Patreon who made that episode possible. It's a really fun episode. We talk a little bit about, you know, how culture slips into things without us even meaning for it to be there, and how religion has taken over Neopets without them even realizing. Tease, have you watched anything or read anything or played anything this week that you've been really into and want to share?
I watched a movie that we had to watch for this episode today, but on a more exciting note, I, for the first time, played Yuma Nikki, which is a very popular RPG Maker horror game. And it's basically just like a dream world horror open. It's not open world, but there's like maps and you kind of roam around and you collect stuff and you kind of, there's like light puzzles, not really even puzzles. It's like, hey, if you have the ability to be a little kitty, use a little kitty costume to make this guy move. Like, it's nothing super serious or anything like that. But it's really good, and there's such a rich vein of fan art for it, and now I understand it. I haven't finished the game, so no spoilers to anybody who might feel inclined to comment. I played for 2 hours today with friends who are seasoned Yuma Nikki players, so they were just watching in delight as I went in completely blind. So I'm going to take that as my thing I did during the week, and it was my birthday this week, so I had a lot of in-person experiences of consumption, and a friend bought me a copy of Silent Hill 3 for my birthday, so I'm really excited about that, so I'll eventually get to finally play that and not just watch a Let's Play of it. What We Do in the Shadows is back.
It is, yes. I haven't watched the new episode yet, but I'm very excited.
It's two. There's two. The season opened with two episodes on Thursday. It was so good. Guys, if you haven't watched What We Do in the Shadows, it's probably my favorite TV show that's airing right now.
It's also the perfect season for it, yeah.
It's so good. It's so good. Highly recommend. All right, what about you, Cass? Sorry for interrupting. Season 7 of Alone. Oh my gosh,
please, no. I watched season 7 of Alone, and if you are, if you've listened to episodes previously, you may remember that Alone is a terrifying survivalist wilderness TV show where they take a bunch of people and drop them with camera equipment and 10 items that they choose and, like, a basic pack and say, well, let's see which of you can live the longest completely isolated and in the wilderness. A man killed a muskox, Tees. That's the second big game kill. You don't know what a muskox is? They are like, so they look, despite being called oxen, they're more closely related to sheep and goats. And they are just, it's almost, you know, pillow or Piloswine from Pokemon?
Yes.
It's a little bit like Piloswine in that it is just a big mass of fur. And they have these horns on the top of their head that are kind of flush to the top of their head and then come down and curl up. Mustache shape. Yeah. Yes. They're very cute. But they're very, very big. And this man shot it with an arrow, and then in attempts to end its life more quickly and humanely and, you know, avoid the attraction of predators, he ran in and killed it with a knife. So that was a lot. Man, it was absolutely like wild. But then, you know, you get shots of him rubbing the brain into his skin because it's so rich with fat that it's good for that chapped Arctic skin. I love to just put Alone on and play Final Fantasy.
That sounds ideal. That sounds really nice, actually.
I light a candle. I sit with Eskel.
Wow, I need to start doing that.
I started watching a spinoff show called Alone the Beast, where they take three people and they put them in a situation with no items whatsoever. And the only thing they have is an animal that has been very recently, a big game animal that has been very recently harvested. And they basically have to live off of that for 30 days. And the very first episode, this one guy taps on like day two because he gets a cough and a fever. And like, that's understandable. And then on day 10 of 30, another dude that is with this woman just goes, I miss my family. I'm going home. So this woman just toughs it out by herself for the rest of it.
Oh my God.
She's like, I need to go hunting today. So I'm going to take this moose scapula and I'm going to throw it at grouse. And she catches one. She gets it. It's very fascinating. It's a really, I just enjoy learning about primitive practices and the ways in which people survived and continued to survive, and also the inherent respect that goes back and forth between nature and a human being in that process. I find it really compelling. Watch Alone with me, Tees. Okay, it'll revitalize your soul.
Maybe it will. I've been playing cards with my mom and grandma a lot this week, and it's been very healing.
What card games do you guys play?
We play Scopa, which is an Italian card game. All my Nancy Drew fans, you know exactly what I'm talking about. But yeah, Scopa is a traditional Italian card game. It's kind of like a match game. You have four cards on the table, and then you have three in your hand, and then you have to pick up cards, and there's like certain points you could get. So you can get cards, most gold, the seven of gold, and then most sevens. And then if you clear the table, you get an additional point. So it's a pretty fast game, and you just get to 11 points. So you just boom, boom, boom. And there's a lot of strategy to it. But you could also just kind of play like a wild card. So if you know people who know how to play well, it's really, really fun. So been playing that a lot with my mom and grandma this past few weeks. Yeah, that's what I've been up to.
I think it's important before we even get into today's episode topic. And if you have looked at the title or the episode summary, you have a good idea of what we're going to be talking about today. But I think it's very important to note and we received a very amusing comment about it in the past. Tease and I are not shy about our feelings on the American government or its military practices. Employment in the military is a nuanced and difficult conversation that is going to be different for every single person. If you as a listener are or ever did serve in the military, you are absolutely welcome here. Please know, however, that this episode is going to be critical of the United States military as a system, structure, and influence over our everyday life. I would also encourage people in their everyday life to be understanding and accommodating and, you know, understand that the world works in difficult, complicated ways and, you know, it doesn't behoove us to condemn people for choosing to serve in the military when for a lot of people that may be their only option. So I would like us to take that and kind of sit with that. Understand that, you know, there are exceptions to every rule and there are rules for every exception. We're talking today about the way in which the military has really infiltrated our media system. And I say infiltrated with purpose. And a little bit about how that has affected our overall cultural landscape. So it's a little bit of a heftier episode, but I think it is very important to talk about. And we're going to start, oddly enough, by talking about Monster Hunter, which was a movie that came out last year. Now, Monster Hunter is a Capcom franchise that began in 2004, and it is an action RPG in which players assume the role of a hunter in a world that is populated by massive, daunting, you guessed it, monsters. I'm talking draconic creatures, wyverns, lizard creatures, giant mammals. They are, and also little cat friends who walk upright on two legs and make food and also hunt with you called palicos. They're very important. They're very good. Monster Hunter games are known for having little to no plot, and if one is present, it is often so firmly papered over the background of the game as a whole that the entire focus is still on this cyclical grind of hunting monsters to get materials to make better gear to hunt monsters. It's not a game that is very rich in terms of its writing, I will say. The game's weapons also are notably not traditional guns like you see in a lot of video games, but anything from giant swords and blades, axes, and crossbow-style bow guns. There's even a glaive that works in tandem with a giant insect, but there's not guns, which is important to the movie. For reasons we will get into. I would also argue, as somebody who has played many Monster Hunter games, I started playing the franchise when it released in 2004, so I'm very familiar with it, that the innate tension and terror and even fun of Monster Hunter is how you as a player, because of your weapon, are forced to be so up close and personal with these absolutely Goliath creatures. It is something that I think as a player makes you both fearful and respectful of this creature that you are hunting, which weirdly enough ties into having watched Alone this week. The Monster Hunter movie began filming in 2018 and it released in 2020. It is about a group of United Nations Rangers being isekai style transported into the world of Monster Hunter via a lightning storm. They're very nebulous about the alignment of the soldiers, the rangers, the troopers, whatever you want to call them. And there's no specific U.S. military iconography. But they all have American accents. I will say that.
And they all have American accents. And they use American terms of rank as well.
Exactly, too. Yeah. So the film's initial teasers and promotionals hadn't given any clue to the presence of a military force. And when later trailers revealed the plot, there was this very overall dubious and sometimes frustrated reaction from fans. I remember myself and friends being like, what the hell are they doing? They've ruined it. Why did they do this? I just want to see big monsters and hunters in outrageous armor, and I do not need the military there. Please and thank you. What are you doing? What were you thinking? Before we get back into the episode, though, I do want to take a quick detour for Tease and I just to kind of talk about this as an adaptation. Mm-hmm. The Tease, what was your overall experience watching this movie?
Bad. Bad. Should have been a tight 90.
Fun bad?
No, just bad. Sends it to the should have been a tight 90 list that I have building. Mm-hmm. It was not enjoyable. It felt gimmicky in the worst way. I feel like I could have just watched Rampage with Dwayne the Rock Johnson, and I could have enjoyed it more.
Dwayne the Rock Johnson.
It was really kind of uninspired, in my opinion. It kind of was just like, hey, look at that. We too love a monstered hunter. Mm-hmm. I've played a video game, and Ron Perlman is there for some reason under a really weird cake of makeup.
Yeah.
The product placement was, yuck. Yeah.
there's a scene in the middle of the movie where she pulls out a Hershey's chocolate bar and the wrapper is just in your face. It is so out of So I do know that Hershey supplies chocolate to the U.S. military, but I'm pretty certain it's not wrapped in Hershey bar wrappers.
Interesting.
They get a much more, they
like
get
a paper.
To my understanding, they actually get like they get squares of chocolate, and a lot of times too, it's a different kind of chocolate than what Hershey's releases, because Hershey's chocolate, not to get into culinary sciences here, but Hershey's chocolate barely qualifies as being chocolate because of its crystal structure.
Oh, interesting. There's also the Coca-Cola can in the beginning too.
No, yeah.
That was odd.
It's a really disorienting and claustrophobic experience in its editing. Mm-hmm. The cuts are really dizzying and fast, and they're done at the oddest moments. Even in, like, these panning establishing shots of the desert, the camera will just, like, cut three different times to a different shot or different mm-hmm. angle. Mm-hmm. There's one instance in which, like, the 180... There's multiple instances in which the 180 degree rule is broken, and it really yanks you out of it as a viewer. Mm-hmm. There's also, I will say, in favor of the movie, I think we come to it with a little bit of different perspective because you're not a big Monster Hunter fan. You have played the latest one.
I've played the newest one, but I respect a Palico when I see one. Mm-hmm. I respect Miss Dodogama, but no.
Mr. Dodogama, elite shit.
We do have two very different experiences with Monster mm-hmm. Hunter, yes. Yeah. I've played my copy maybe for 10 hours tops, mm-hmm. as much as I wish I could play more, but whatever.
This movie did actually make me want to play it again, which
really?
Is, you know, that's something.
Let's play. I will love to smack people with
my
big old harp.
There's a really nice attention to detail in this movie in the behavior of the monsters and the choice to make one of the key monsters, not just a Diablos, but a Black Diablos. I do kind of resent that the Black Diablos was used as sort of the build-up enemy to the Rathalos, because I'm sorry, Rathalos is baby shit compared to Black Diablos. They do make the Black Diablos like really notoriously difficult to hunt in the movie, which I thought was really nice. Mm-hmm. And it's canonically and incredibly dangerous and hard to kill or even afflict with status conditions. So there's a point where he shoots it in the eye with a poison arrow and it takes forever for this thing to pass out. They mirror the actual movements of attacks in-game, and you see scout flies in the back of the hunter's makeshift blinds, and there are lizards crawling around on the stone in the same way they do in the game. Your fun Monster Hunter fact of the day, just because I really like to talk about Monster Hunter, is that the Black Diablos is actually the female Diablos in the height of mating season, which I think it's cool. They didn't just make a Diablos, they made it a Black Diablos. That made me really happy. They did Mr. Meowskular Shift so fucking dirty, though.
Oh, God.
Oh, it was so
That was so
upsetting.
Scary. I do not like
he
that.
He looks bad, and he makes, like, a weird pass at Mila Jovovich's character.
Yeah.
I don't like it.
I also thought the costuming was oddly disappointing in a way, because there are ways to make that look so much more realistic, but it kind of just looked like a very sad quilted armor set for the most part.
Yeah, the thing about Monster Hunter armor is that it's really big and it's really voluminous, and a lot of times it's really super colorful, and I think the movie did itself a disservice by immediately planting itself in the desert. And so the first hour of this hour and 45 minute long movie is spent in this really desolate landscape with little to no color.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that for budgetary reasons, you know, they could not include every single monster. They had to be very conservative about which ones they picked and where they put them. But I'll get into a little bit more of why this doesn't work and why the military aspect of this movie really, really hurt it.
Mm.
Also, they didn't even have Poogie. What are you doing?
What are you doing without Poog?
Give me the Poog. I think there was just too much of this attempt to, like, stray toward realism in a way that sort of hurt it.
And,
like,
yeah, no,
Ron Perlman, I will say, could have looked a lot like the character he's mirrored after.
Okay.
But the way in which they did his, I think their fear of making things into big, outrageous forms really hurt them.
Yeah, definitely.
It's one of those things that probably shouldn't have been a live action movie, if we could just be totally honest.
Yeah, that's actually a really good point.
So the film is led by Mila Jovovich and Tony Jaa, but Tony Jaa's speaking lines are almost exclusively clipped short and in a, according to the subtitles, alien language. When Mila's character meets the rest of the hunting party, their leader, who is played by Ron Perlman, as Tease mentioned, miraculously speaks fluent English, and he uses it exclusively, like, in battle taunts and everything. It's not, like, his second language or something. He mentions that he's met people from this other world that Mila's character comes from, and he made a study of their language. So he just speaks it fluently and colloquially, and I'm just a little bit like, what are you doing? I want to ask why Tony Jaa's character, who is Ron Perlman's second, wasn't also taught the English language. And it also just generally leaves a really bad taste in my mouth that all the people of color in this movie were killed off in the first 20 minutes. And then the lead, who is a man of color, is incredibly limited in his communication throughout the entire movie. And he isn't even given a name beyond the title of Hunter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's bad.
Yeah. When I was watching it, I was like, I wonder if there's going to be like one token Asian girl, one fucking token Asian girl.
So the thing is that everyone except for the military characters is modeled directly after characters we see in Monster Hunter World, which was the big successful release.
Yeah.
These are characters that, like, exist and actually have characterization, personalities. The whole, like, backstory with Tony Jaa's character's seemingly significant other and child having been killed by a Rathalos,
mm-hmm.
that wasn't in the game.
Of course not. Like, of course it wasn't. There's
the handler,
no plot.
The handler is there. You know, listen, I refer to her as Chelsea Handler, so if you hear me call her Chelsea, that's why. But the Hunter's Handler is there. We see, like, the background characters. It's just,
mm-hmm.
there could have been more here, and it's very clear that the director was aware of the source material mm-hmm. and knew it intimately and tried to, like, model things directly after it, but I guess just said kind of fuck it to it. It was Monster Hunter World's success that led to so much interest in this movie being made, and Paul Anderson has had the rights to the Monster Hunter movie for quite a while now because he's wanted to make this movie. And so when Monster Hunter World came out and it was such a success, a bunch of companies wanted to grab up that IP, but it was already owned by him. Monster Hunter World actually has, of all the Monster Hunter games, the most plot and also the most compelling plot.
Uh-huh.
It would have been easy to use this as a foundation for the movie's plot. In Monster Hunter World, the hunter joins an expedition to a new world that is completely unexplored by their society to study and learn the ecology of the monsters there. Some of those monsters are familiar, but most of them are incredibly new. So you literally could have had that. That's what's really frustrating to me mm-hmm. is, like, Monster Hunter is a really rich, abundant world that, you know who I would let do a live action Monster Hunter movie, as silly as this sounds? James Cameron.
Huh.
If I could get a Monster Hunter movie that was even a tenth of the effort and passion that James Cameron put into Avatar, I would be very pleased. Because James Cameron understood the point of world building with Avatar. And listen, we don't remember the characters or the story of Avatar, but we do remember those visuals because mm-hmm. they were incredible, they were beautiful, they were breathtaking.
Mm-hmm.
You remember all the different creatures that you saw. that is the kind of thing I think a live action Monster Hunter should be about. It is about the world itself mm-hmm. and the monsters within it. In an interview with IGN, Paul Anderson, who is the movie's director, stated,
"I was influenced by the first time I played the game, or anyone plays the game. You know, you're a modern person going into this world and discovering it for the first time. And you're doing so with a character you've created. So you're essentially a stranger going into this world, and I wanted to recreate this sense of wonder I had the first time I went into this world. You can only have that sense of wonder if you're seeing it with fresh eyes."
I don't feel like he achieved this with the movie. I feel like the closest you get to that moment and that sensation is when she and the hunter come and find the Apsaros when they're feeding and drinking at that watering hole. But otherwise, the narrative is largely fueled by fear and disdain. So there's not even a respect for the sort of majesty of this giant predatory creature. It's very much, "It killed my comrades, I need to kill it." And I don't really like that. I think that's against the spirit of Monster Hunter, as odd as that sounds.
One of the things I hated the most about the movie, I guess it wasn't hated, but what frustrated me about the movie was that there was no cohabitation with the monsters the way that the games do. You know, in the games, like, if you don't want to hurt a monster, you can just walk past it and it won't attack you for the most part. Mm-hmm. I mean, some species will, but some don't. And why couldn't you have showed that? But also, people don't want that.
There's a lot of like little critters and creatures in mm-hmm. Monster Hunter that you can capture too, or that we see kind of kept as pets, or that yep. we work in tandem with. That's a huge part of the Palico storyline mm-hmm. as a whole, right? Is yep. that there are Palicos that, you know, live as basically indigenous tribes in areas, but there are also Palicos who live in tandem with humans and mm-hmm. this elder species of humanoids. There is a respect and understanding of nature that comes into Monster Hunter and plays into this real world idea too of hunters being one of the greatest contributors to ecological balance. Monster Hunter has had numerous collaborations as a franchise with other game properties, which isn't really an uncommon thing to attract a new audience. Monster Hunter World itself had collaborations with Final Fantasy XIV and The Witcher. They're both super duper fun. It's really fun seeing Moogles in the world of Monster Hunter, and it's really cool seeing the Rathalos when I'm playing Final Fantasy XIV. I love crossovers. I think they're a really cool way to play with properties and mix visuals. Paul Anderson cites the Monster Hunter collaboration with Metal Gear as the reason for bringing the military into his Monster Hunter story. Would you like to read this quote as well, Tease?
Oh, that whole sentence just hurt me.
Yeah. For
so many reasons. Oh.
Yeah.
"The idea of a kind of military person was suggested by a crossover that Monster Hunter did with Metal Gear Solid, where you got to be Snake Solid and shoot these creatures with a machine gun. I thought, well, that's organic to the game because it's already been done. Plus, it's in an interesting way." Oh my god. This man's never even played Metal Gear 3, has he? Oh my god. Oh my god. Oh god, Jesus Christ.
Metal Gear, ironically, is quite anti-military, isn't it?
It sure is. It really is, yeah.
I think the funny part of this, too, is that game collaborations aren't usually treated as being canonical, and they're normally excused by some circumstance of, like, Deus Ex Machina to get them to happen, to give fans just enough immersion for it to work. But the new world storyline of Monster Hunter World already had a baked-in idea of unfamiliarity and new world wonder, and also the bowgun exists. There's really no want of heavy firepower in the Monster Hunter canon. You've got giant barrel bombs, terrifying ballistas, contraptions of giant spinning harpoon tips that are meant to plunge into a wyvern and trap them in place as they shred them. The Palicos have even made their own mini tanks, so the idea of larger ones being developed is plausible. Because I did see a reviewer being like, "You know, I thought it was dumb that the military was in this until I saw the Rathalos fighting a tank, and then I was like, hell yeah." And I'm like, first of all, the Rathalos didn't fight that tank. The Rathalos ripped the top off that tank and ate everybody inside. It didn't even get off a shot at the Rathalos. No. But the question here becomes, why does the military, and particularly the United States military, have such a foothold in movies that seemingly aren't about them and really shouldn't have even been about them. The simple answer, dear listener and dear Tease, is propaganda.
Mm.
Before we delve further into it, this, I know propaganda can often be used as a buzzword or a sort of, I don't want to say dog whistle, but it's often used to invoke fear in people and employ a lot of fear mongering. So let's start by just generally defining propaganda and its information, particularly information that may be biased or misleading, that is used to promote and platform ideas or beliefs. We get into this topic and, you know, discuss the harm of it, especially as it relates to parasocialism in our parasocial propaganda and profit episodes. This is something we kind of frequently touch on whenever we get into the more political side of the way fandom interacts with media. Like any government structure, the United States military has a really vested interest in making sure that U.S. citizens like, support, and are comfortable with both the idea and the actions of a military force. That level of support and goodwill generally encourages people to enlist, it keeps funding and budget strong, and as a poor relationship between citizens and the military might mean aggressive blowback, that might also, you know, get people upset about increased taxpayer funding. I would like to take this moment to highlight something that's really important in this discussion because I don't think a lot of people are aware of this or quite the extent of the U.S. military structure, but according to the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, the United States Department of Defense spends more than the next 11 highest spending countries combined on its military. The United States Department of Defense spent $778 billion in 2020 alone. That number could be cut in half, and the United States would still have spent more than $130 billion more than China did, China being the second highest spender in the world on its military. The rough colloquial estimate is that about half of every dollar you pay to taxes goes to military spending in the United States. That goes to everything in the Department of Defense. So that's paying employees, that is, you know, intel, security systems, weapons, any sort of pay for people who are employed or a part of the Department of Defense. It is very wide spanning. We saw the United States military take an active interest in media during World War II, which is where this all kind of starts. The United States Office of War Information had a unit at the time that was exclusive to Hollywood. And in a CBC series called Myths on the Screen, Hollywood at War, Tanner Merlise, who is an associate professor of communication and digital media studies, says that between 1942 and 45, the Bureau reviewed 1,652 scripts, revising or discarding anything that portrayed the U.S. unfavorably, including any material that made Americans seem oblivious to the war or anti-war. The head of the Office of War Information was Elmer Davis, who said, "The easiest way to inject a propaganda idea into most people's minds is to let it go through the medium of an entertainment picture when they do not realize they're being propagandized."
Bro, I hate this so much.
Yeah, how do you feel about that, Tease?
Oh my god. I knew all this information, but then when you're reminded, it makes me so upset. In so many ways, it's frustrating to think that I understand that we are a country with a lot of people in it. I understand that we're a very big country. I understand that we have a lot of relationships with countries that quote unquote need our help.
As the American government will justify it, yeah.
Yeah, I understand that we have been at war, essentially. I mean, quote unquote, we just ended a war for the past 20 years with Afghanistan. Like, I'm aware of all of these things. And yet, the amount of money that I can't help but think about how this could have fixed so many other things in this country. Or not even necessarily fixed, but just begun to give its people the proper aid it needs instead of having its fucking nose in everything.
When you think about that number for 2020, right, and you think of all the people who either didn't get stimulus checks, people who ended up homeless, people who died, and it becomes more and more infuriating.
And I think I'm also even frustrated about, what about how can you have all this money and yet you still can't take care of your veterans properly? How can you
exactly
take care of this and not sometimes even pay the people who do sign up, in fact, to become a part of your military? How can, like, it makes me so angry on so many different ways. Oh, God. Mm-hmm. Shout out to that guy who called us a leftist in that one episode. Get ready to call us one again. Like, oh my God, it makes me so mad. Anyway, keep going.
Yeah, so that piece goes on to detail how integral the act of seeing movies was to the American culture at the time. And in a time before at-home streaming or even in-home televisions, movies were an experience where you were surrounded by dozens and even hundreds of other people from your community all sharing in the same experience.
Also, I don't know if people really realize this, but going to the movies was not necessarily what we know as going to the movies as today. Mm-hmm. People would go to the movies upwards of to like 3 to 4 times a week. And it wouldn't just be one movie. You would see like a double feature. And there would also be a short 15 to 30 minute film either before or in between. Sometimes it was just newsreels that were in fact about wars. Sometimes it was promotional mini movies, usually surrounding to music and like cash grabs and stuff like that. So if there was a cash grab related to a war, you would see war propaganda before. You would like the amount of movie going that people would be capable of from the 40s to even like the 60s is something that we even as moviegoers today really can't fathom. I'm a big moviegoer. I go pretty frequently. I think everybody knows that. And even I don't go to the movies 3 times a week.
It's a lot.
And I don't see 2 movies a day. Like, even when I'm home watching movies, I very rarely watch more than one movie in a day. Like,
In the 1940s, approximately 90 million Americans went to the movies each and every week. That's 90 million Americans who, it's not 90 million Americans were going, you know, they went, you know, once a week. It's every single week they were going to the movies at least once. Pearl Harbor was the first modern moment of outside threat to the United States citizen in a lot of ways, and the United States government became fearful that others would also employ propaganda to shake the citizens' faith in the U.S. military and government. Nick Cole, who is a professor of public diplomacy, says,
"To me, there are many complexities in the story, including the treatment of Japanese Americans, for example, or the dropping of the atomic bomb or the failure to understand the Holocaust and to react appropriately. But Hollywood managed to find ways of making Americans the good guys, Nazis the bad guys. All's right with the world. It can be turned into a very affirming, very bankable narrative."
I mean, that's part of the issue with any media we watch, right, is that it's very difficult to include the entirety of the story, and especially the modern consumer, I would say, and this is totally anecdotal on my part, but I would say the modern consumer doesn't necessarily love a movie that makes them think or forces them to question things. I think of a lot of the backlash to Parasite in particular about how people were very frustrated with that movie because it either said something to them that they didn't like, or it asked them to sit with something and really think about something and come to a conclusion on their own that they didn't want to. So after Vietnam, both propaganda and politicians fueled an undercurrent of perpetual fear in the American people that was used to build the cause of a national security state to protect people from what was at the time the quote-unquote threat of communism. But this has sort of percolated in our culture to a generalized paranoia that has bloomed in the size of our military budget. If people are scared, they want to be protected, and a massive military can contribute to making them feel protected, or at the very least, it justifies for them the exorbitant spending upon the military. And it was Hollywood, in large part, that was used and continues to be used as a bludgeoning driver for that fear. If you have seen any Marvel movie, you are likely aware that they have received, in most cases, the full support of the United States Department of Defense. Even Iron Man, which on its surface was very critical of weapons manufacturers and war profiteering, but portrayed the military favorably enough to receive the thumbs up. I will say before we get into the rest of this that the first Avengers movie, like just the Avengers, did not get the support of the Department of Defense because the Department of Defense did not like how nebulous and sort of ill-defined SHIELD was as an organization. And so they weren't on board with that. But then they came back on board for Winter Soldier, and we'll get into that. But what does the United States Department of Defense support mean, and why is it worth anything to filmmakers? I think that's an important thing that we take a look at. Movies are really expensive to make. Even a really simple movie with little to no effects and unglamorous everyday costuming can cost millions and millions and millions of dollars. It's a big thing when a movie is made on a super shoestring budget. I think M. Night Shyamalan's The Visit got a lot of hype because of how cheaply made it was and, you know, how high production it still looked. Cities and towns will build their permits around the concept of being production friendly to drive up both business and tourism. So New York City just casually advertises how film friendly it is on the subway. Pretty much anytime you see an advertisement for a TV show or a movie on the subway, there will be like a little yellow banner underneath it that'll be like, made in New York because of the efforts of Bill de Blasio or whatever. Wherever production can save money, it likely will. That's why you see a lot of TV shows that are made in various Canadian cities. It's why The Bachelor hops around to so many different locations throughout the season. It is all about optimizing their budget. If a production is looking to include any sort of military equipment, whether that is firearms, vehicles, or aircrafts, whatever it is, they can work with the United States DOD to make that happen. The DOD has an entertainment media branch. This is a thing that exists. This is a thing that is present. It is a thing that is very much working and in power today. That branch's role is to ensure the credibility and image of the DOD in media. Film productions that have a large budget or have already been sold to a studio are more likely to receive military support if they apply for it, which means if you have made a movie and your plan is to, or not if you have made a movie, if you're planning to make a movie and your intention is to try and just sell it at the Sundance Film Festival, the DOD is not going to be as keen on that. They want to make sure that they are investing in something that people will see. In a discussion with military.com, Glenn Roberts, who is the chief of the entertainment media branch, says, "Our mission, you know, our formal explanation is that we inform and educate the public, both the domestic and the foreign public, on the roles and missions of the Department of Defense. That's why we exist, really, to make sure that Americans know their taxpayer dollars are being used in good stewardship."
So they're saying monsters are real and we need to kill them. All right. Thank you.
I think what's case closed. Worrying to me... What's more worrying to me about this statement, and we'll come to this a little bit later, is this moment where he says they're trying to educate and inform the public, not just domestic American public, but also the foreign public. So part of this is a little bit grandstanding. It's saying to other nations, look at the power and might of the United States military. Look at what we're capable of.
We can kill monsters, and we will. Aliens, fuck you too.
Is a ranger.
So I hate it. Can I just say something? I hate it that they called her ma'am the whole entire time. I'm not like commander or ranger. For fucking God's sake, the whole Velcro scene with the fucking ranger tag. Why could you just call her ranger the whole time? You had to call her ma'am. Woman. Ugh.
Yeah.
I'm done.
Well, that really frustrating moment, too, where she's like, all right, let's go, ladies. And one of her teammates, subordinates, it's not totally clear, goes, you know, she's a woman and she still manages to make that sound like an insult. It's like, oh, God. Okay.
Beg me to shut the fuck up. Beg you.
So the script, in order to receive any help from the military in securing those military assets to include in production, has to be approved. Robert says that villains can be shown in uniform or as members of the Department of Defense, but it's about the overall image of the DOD and military that matters to them. He speaks about the importance of only spending taxpayer money, which is what funds the DOD, including this media entertainment branch, on things that will be seen by the public at large. They're not interested in indie films. They're not interested in relatively small productions. They're not interested in things that are going to have a limited release. They want giant blockbusters because that's what's going to be seen by the most people. The relationship between film production and United States military is how you end up with movies that are co-scripted by the Department of Defense. Movies like Captain Marvel, Wonder Woman 1984, Iron Man, Top Gun, I Am Legend, so many more. It's probably, I cannot say this with certainty, but it is probably how Monster Hunter had access to its vehicles, uniforms, and other various props. The really difficult and frustrating part of this is that we don't know when a movie has the approval of the Department of Defense or when the Department of Defense has worked on it. That is something that the Department of Defense does not release to people or make readily known. It is almost never open information when they have worked on the film, and the DoD can and does demand changes to scripts and even entire plot lines if you want to use their equipment. There is an argument to be made about how the Department of Defense demanding script changes may actually be unconstitutional in that it sort of abridges freedom of speech, as well as its use of taxpayer money to expand their influence in the movie industry. I'm not going to go into this in depth, but if you'll remember when Seth Rogen and James Franco released The Interview, there was a huge hubbub. Because it's a movie that depicts Kim Jong-un being killed in a way that is not in any way godly or deified. And so North Korea was purportedly very upset about this. And it's not clear who was behind the hack, but the DoD was hacked and a whole bunch of information was released. And if you actually go to, I believe it's spyculture.com, I think I bring them up a little bit later, there is, you know, a record of films that have, we do know, been supported by the DoD.
The FBI and the Pentagon have both engaged in decades of direct intervention with television and film. J. Edgar Hoover, the FBI's founding director, served as a de facto co-producer for the 1959 drama, The FBI Story, even going as far as to play himself and force reshoots of scenes that he felt didn't portray the FBI in an appropriate light. Hoover spent the rest of his life intervening in movies like 1962's Moon Pilot, in which he pressured Disney to change the bumbling FBI agent into a generic federal security officer to avoid besmirching the good name of the agency. Walt Disney even served as an FBI informant who turned in alleged communists in a return for the ability to film inside FBI headquarters. Despite claiming that its formal relationship with Hollywood is over, there is evidence that the FBI continues to review and approve movies. Guys, guess what? Disney owns Marvel. You're telling me that they don't have a relationship? You're fucking ridiculous if you don't believe that. Anyway, I mean, if you do believe that. Anyway.
I spent time with my anger about this whole topic last night. And so today, while we're recording, I'm just very... It makes me... I think melancholy is the most appropriate word. I try not to get too caught up in the nihilism of it, because I don't find that to be very productive. But, you know, I think it's important that we sit with this and acknowledge that it is a reality, and we have to work to affect change in that way, and also affect awareness.
Yes.
I want to, in this moment, though, make you think back to depictions you have seen of other countries in media. I want you to think about Breaking Bad, who polishes every shot of Mexico with a heavy yellow veneer. I want you to think about Stranger Things, who has concocted a needling, nefarious plot about the invasion of Russian scientists into small town America. And I want you to think about every video game you have ever played where your enemy, the target in front of your gun, is an Arab person. There is an idea known as the soft war, where media and culture is used to influence another country and slowly rot and topple it from the inside out. And this war goes hand in hand with traditional warfare. It's incredibly not It's relevant when we talk about the interview. It's relevant when we talk about the depiction of other countries in our Marvel movies and in every other movie. It's almost always, unfortunately, relevant. And it's relevant when we talk about that quote, right? Tisa sent me a meme that I imagine they have just made of, it's the utopian meme where you see a utopian society and it says society if the DOD didn't rewrite movies. But it's relevant when we talk about that quote from Glenn Roberts of our mission is to inform and educate the public, both domestic and foreign. So mm-hmm. not only is it coloring the ideas of American citizens, it's also affecting the views a foreign nation may have of its own government. American blockbuster movies often champion strong military, democracy, and almost comically heroic government officials. And as the American market began to move into Chinese theaters, we saw many of our movies pivot from being anti-Chinese to anti-North Korean. And there is a whole host of layers of yuck to that problem that I am sure you can imagine. Captain America, Winter Soldier, which the Department of Defense did work on, harkens back to our earlier talk about the stewing of American paranoia in the government. The DOD actually saw this movie as pinning the villainy upon non-American infiltrators, Hydra, whose ties are to that of the Nazi Party, and they also believed that it enjoyed the positive portrayal of military veterans in Steve Rogers and Sam Wilson. I will say, like, that's a part of Winter Soldier I enjoy, is the fact that you see veterans in recovery and with support. But that's not the reality for a lot of American veterans. A lot of them don't have access to those resources. They end up homeless. They're not taken care of in that way. But of course, the Department of Defense has a vested interest in convincing both potential recruits, currently serving people who have military family, that their actively enlisted or previously enlisted family are going to be taken care of. You could make the argument that early Marvel films' critiques of the United States military are evidence of their intent to tell their own stories, be those like the Marvel stories, with or without the Department of Defense approval, but the reality is that both companies are doing what is best for them budgetarily. Positive military portrayals mean subsidized budgets for productions and easier recruiting for the military, and when I don't know if people totally understand the scope to which we're talking about a portion of the budget being covered. And a lot of the things that people want for productions, you know, whether that's aircrafts, vehicles, uniforms, those things cost thousands, hundreds of thousands, millions of dollars that they can shave off their budget by working with the Department of Defense. And if it means tiny little script changes, most of the time they'll take it, especially when you're working with a giant conglomerate like Disney that wants to make as much money as possible and have as wide reach as possible. Tom Secker, who runs Spy Culture, which is the website I mentioned before, it's an archive of government involvement in the entertainment industry, says that the first two Iron Man films benefited from over $1 billion worth of planes and equipments as props and set dressing.
Oh my God. That's so much money.
That's $1 billion that wasn't it. I want to make it clear. It's not $1 billion that's being given to that production. It's $1 billion worth of equipment. So it's like it's covering the production and manufacturing cost of that equipment. I don't know quite, and we don't know in general, if that equipment is being rented, if it's being bought at cost. We don't totally know what the deal is there. But over $1 billion worth of planes and equipment as props and set dressing. Tom Secker doesn't believe that Marvel films could have become the massive success that they are without the help and approval of the Department of Defense. And I think that's fair. I think that's valid.
Agreed. Yeah.
I want to talk now a little bit about the subtle and not so subtle ways that the Department of Defense uses the media you love to get you to enlist. I watch a pretty broad scope of content, but when I'm on gameplay or Let's Play stints, my ads on YouTube pretty unanimously change to enlistment ads. Anytime I'm watching things about video games, my ads almost immediately become U.S. Army recruitment, Navy recruitment, that sort of thing. If I'm on Twitch, they are almost always military recruitment ads that I get. Buddy, I'm watching people play Stardew Valley. I am not your audience. Recent ad campaigns, again, this is anecdotal. This is from my experience. But recent ad campaigns have a decidedly video game character selection screen vibe to me, and they have had for many years. They have these polygon decorations all around the corners of the screen. They have a sort of grungy Call of Duty smear to their vignettes. The titles for each branch are presented as though you're choosing a team or a faction. And I'm remembering right now in this moment when I used to watch G4, when that was still a thing, you know, it's coming back or it is back, but when I was a teenager and when I was a preteen watching G4, the amount of military recruitment ads was rich everywhere. There is a whole separate discussion that is in some ways a little more positive about how the military has employed the use of video games, sometimes in really terrifying ways, sometimes in really productive and health conscious ways to help people with PTSD, but that's not what this episode is about. In 2018, the U.S. Army sponsored an official esports team made up of active duty and reserve personnel. The American Civil Liberties Union actually sued them after they had Twitch users banned for discussing war crimes committed by the United States in chat, because that's actually a violation of First Amendment rights, buddy. If people come in and just want to be like, hey, the U.S. did this, you can't have them banned off Twitch. That's not harassment. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez actually filed a draft amendment to the House Appropriations Bill that would have prohibited the U.S. military from hosting a presence on Twitch, in video games, esports, or live streaming platforms, but it was defeated in vote. And I think that actually maybe would have been a very good thing with some very careful wording, but, you know, obviously all laws have to be very carefully worded, but it disturbs me that the military is actively able to advertise to children.
Mm-hmm.
The U.S. Army esports team also promoted a giveaway for an Xbox Elite Series 2 controller, but when you clicked on the link to enter the giveaway, it took you to a military recruitment form. There are lots of little insidious things like this that the U.S. military has done to try and drive up enlistment rates. I keep going back to Marvel movies. It is because they are the most blatantly obvious and accessible examples of what we are talking about. So think of it as your introductory course to spotting propaganda by the military. Captain Marvel, whose main character Carol Danvers is an Air Force pilot, actually contributed to what the Air Force says were their highest number of female applicants in over 5 years upon release. It's dizzying to think of just the little effect that kind of thing has. Independence Day Resurgence was an... I don't know if anybody remembers this, but this was kind of terrifying. So Independence Day Resurgence.
I was just about to ask about this.
Yeah. Advertised the opportunity to join the Earth Space Defense. And gee, when you went to the website to find out more about the movie, there happened to be links to check out the U.S. Army careers. And if you wanted some exclusive preview content for the upcoming movie, you just had to give the literal U.S. Army access to your Facebook page. Like, full privacy allowance. You just got to let them in, and you would get bonus access to the movie. There are... advertised website also included a game of quote-unquote training missions and shared upon beating a related military position and the general job description, you know, for reasons. So you would play this little game and it would be like, cool, you did a really good job at that. Did you know about this position in the military where they handle these things? It's kind of similar to what you just did. Wasn't that fun?
No, it wasn't.
In Monster Hunter, Mila's character Artemis is a ranger, a branch of the military that was only recently opened to women. She's a powerhouse, she's incredible in combat, she's resourceful and funny. And Tease, I'm thinking that maybe if I enlist, I'll get caught in an interdimensional space storm and I'll get to pet an Apsaros. I'm really excited about that.
I'm going to tell you this one, bud, but... that's not gonna happen.
I think it's gonna happen. I think you just need to believe. I think the military can make it happen.
Press F to pay respects. That's the only aspect of the military that I'm participating in, is pressing F. That's it.
The things you're watching have a conscious and purposeful choice in their visuals to get you to feel a certain type of way about a certain type of thing. Maybe you are tired, and maybe you are working really hard, and maybe you're exhausted by the world at large and how small and insignificant you feel in all of it. The United States military advertises goals, purpose, and significance. It also tries to advertise security and education in a future. when you want to lie down and turn off your brain and not think about how wicked the world feels. I know you don't want to think about what you're watching, and that is okay. But I also want you to consider that sometimes exactly what fuelers and purveyors of propaganda want. We don't always know who's paying for the things we're watching or who's helping them get made and everything they're trying to say. But consider the picture beyond the screen. I think it's important that you ask yourself about the realism of the character's intentions. I think you should ask yourself what narrative it serves. I think you should ask yourself why the story about giant otherworldly monsters needed to be stacked with the big bursting toys of the US military that are used in our real world everyday lives to kill everyday people. I think it's really important that we talk about this because the military relies on your love, dedication, and fandom of a property to appeal to you, and in that, make the military appealing to you. Do you have any final thoughts, Tease?
Yeah, you know what doesn't have military propaganda in it? Listen, guys, go on YouTube, type in pimple popping videos, turn off your sound, turn on some music you like.
Yeah.
Watch the pimple popping videos and just listen to music. It's a great way to pass time. I do it all the fucking time.
Yeah.
Don't have to think about military propaganda. I get to pet my cat in peace. You know what? Play Tetris 99.
Yeah.
That doesn't have military propaganda in it. And maybe you will see me on Tetris 99 together. Like, I get it. Things are fun. It's fun to watch movies with explosions. It's fun to see big monsters get exploded. I get it. But, like, there's a lot of things that you can surround yourself with. And I simply just don't want to surround myself with military propaganda.
Companies aren't stupid. And a lot of times they will do in their writing is, somebody used the example of they called this group the Flag Smashers or whatever, right? And a lot of times you will have a villain who has these ideals of, like, let's just be honest, they have socialist ideas, they have humanist ideas, they are trying to purvey those. And on the surface level, right, they present that villain as being very compelling. And then the villain does something that is so out of left field, like killing a child. That is a purposeful choice to get you to align socialist and humanist ideals with child killing, despite the fact that those things are not congruent and they don't actually have anything to do with one another, and one does not cause the other. That is a purposeful choice, and that's propaganda. And I think it's just, again, I think you just need to be aware and ask questions and be critical of your media. And I know sometimes you don't want to be critical, but I think it's really important for you as a well-rounded citizen with any engagement in their government, the power structures that determine a lot of aspects of your life, to be critical of the things you are watching. It doesn't mean you need to go and read discourse. It doesn't mean you need to hate the thing. There are tons of things that I love that I look at and I read them or I watch them and I'm really grossed out by some of the things in them. I still enjoy them, but I enjoy them with the conscious understanding that there are things in them that aren't good, or there are things in them that are trying to sway my ideas to something that I don't fundamentally believe in. That's just an aspect of human life and relationship with art. That's why you take your humanities classes, you know? Sometimes the curtains aren't just blue. Sometimes the curtains are purposefully blue to malign your thoughts and feelings about something. So that has been Author's Note. Thank you so much for listening and making it to the end of the episode. We can't tell you how much we appreciate your support. Just listening helps us, helps boost us, you know, helps people find us. If you really enjoyed the show, a great way to support us is by leaving a review on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen to us. If you're interested in joining our Patreon, we do bonus episodes over there. We have an exclusive podcast that's just for patrons over there. You also get to take part in fun polls to help decide what our next topic will be for the month. You can find us on Patreon and Ko-fi at Authors Note Pod. You can find any information about our show, where to find us on the internet, where you can listen to us in other locations on our website at authorsnotepod.com. If you haven't, and maybe subscribe to us on YouTube, even if you don't listen to us over there. Just I don't know. It's fun watching that little number go up.
It is.
My name is Cass, and you can find me anywhere across the internet at Valhethella. That's V-A-L-H-E-T-H-E-L-L-A. Tease, where can people find you at?
You can find me at Vicunad. That's V-I-C-U-N-A-D. You could also find me on Fandom Spotlight, which is the word fandom and spotlight as spotlite.com. They also have a YouTube channel if you want to check that out. Our theme music was done by James Wyula. You could find him on Bandcamp under James Y. And Cass, who did our cover art?
Our cover art is done by the ever wonderful Nyaliest. You can find her on Twitter at Nyaliest. That's N-Y-A-L-L-I-E-S-T. Tees, what's something that doesn't have a fandom that you wish did?
I think we should appreciate the people who do the logo redesigns for translated manga covers.
Hell yeah. I love that.
Yeah, right? Like, yeah. Every time I watch a video about it, I'm like, damn, they work so hard. They're so smart. They need a bigger fandom. They don't have a fandom, but they should have one.
Until next time, viewers, please get your vaccines, continue to wear your mask to stop the spread, be conscious of the people around you, be critical in what you're watching, and most of all, do something nice for yourself and be safe.
Bye! Bye.